notes?
Yes. Scribbles.
Scribble, scribble, scribble.
Okay, so thank you very much, Tom Anderson, for bringing that the new restoration of Edward Muybridge's Praxicographer to London. My name is Koji Reshin. I'm one part of the Otolith group. It's my pleasure to be in conversation with Tom Anderson for I think the next, I think we'll talk for about 15 minutes or so, and then we'll open it out to the audience, and I think we have to finish before 7 so that we can move on to the next screening. There's many things to say about this film, which I've seen, I think, for the third or fourth time now, but I think I'm really only beginning to grasp its scale and its ambition and its greatness now. And there are many shocks to thought in this film. And meeting just now, you delivered another one of them, in which you said that you revealed that work on Edward Muybridge had begun around 1964, you said. So that's...
No, the production actually began around 1966, yeah.
Yeah, so could you talk about that? That's an eight-year process until the work it's dated to 74, and you say it was released in 75.
That's right.
If you could you give us a bit of a sense of how you were conceiving this work in 66, and what brought you to the figure of Muybridge and to his work?
You mean why it took so long to make this? Is that one of your questions?
I don't think that's a long time. You know, it's the time it takes. It's more how you in that moment how you came to become fascinated by Muybridge. And to sustain that interest over this period of time.
Yeah. No, it was a long time for me. Those 8 years were very difficult ones. Well, first of all, let's see. Yeah, there was. I took off a year and I made another film, which was the one about rock and roll.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That was a great film. That was 66 to 67. So then I returned to this in 67. And then, there were a lot of things. I mean, first of all, looking back on it later, I realized it was a project that I wasn't really... capable of making. It was something that I set out to do, and I really didn't have the means, the knowledge, or the ability to make this film. And so I was saved by some fortunate circumstances. Well, there was my first collaborator on the film was my wife Faye, who during the course of it got sick. She had a brain tumor, which happened in 1971, and then there was 2.5 years where she was ill, and I was taking care of her, so I wasn't working on the movie. And then, but kind of before that, it had gotten stalled. I think I ran out of money, basically. And then, finally, in 1974, kind of through a fluke, I was able to get the money that was necessary to... complete the film, and was able to find other collaborators in, which was Morgan Fisher, who worked on the editing, and Michael Cohen, who wrote the music. So, yeah, there was definitely a time when it seemed that it would never. Although I'd put in a tremendous amount of work, and I had a cut. I know that because I used to project it kind of over and over, and I was proud that it always made it through the projector, despite all of the splices I'd made. There was a certain period when it kind of died, and that was a very discouraging time, certainly. Not exactly how that happened, I don't remember, but I think it was just somehow either I didn't have the money or I couldn't see how to go forward at that point. I don't quite recall, but it was. Of course, when did I? I guess, actually, the kind of outline for the script was an article that I wrote about Muybridge that was published in Film Culture. I think that was in 1965, and one thing that I think, I mean, it was a time when a lot of other people were discovering Muybridge, as you mentioned before. Among them, you mentioned Dan Graham and Hollis Frampton, and it was a time when there was a great interest in serial imagery. There was a important show on serial imagery that was at the Pasadena Museum of Art, which kind of went from probably Monet to Warhol. And there was also a great interest in this notion of the grid in art at that time, and it was a time that, you know, the beginning of Solowit's work, which he called conceptual art. And if you look at his essay about conceptual art that was in Art Form, he mentions a lot of artists, some of whom I knew were friends. So I think it was really just something in the air, and I'm sure if I realized what I was getting into in making the film, I wouldn't have done it. Because people warned me, certainly, that it was a bad idea. You know, an hour-long, actually, you know, animated film is kind of a, for one or two people to make, is kind of a crazy, impossible. But, and also people said, well, yeah, Muybridge might be interesting for 20 minutes, but for an hour or longer, no way. So that was another issue that I had to confront as well. So,
well, there's a couple of things I want to come back on. I want to talk a bit about music later on. Maybe a animation, I think, is key. It's really key to what I think separates your interest, which I think it precedes Dan Graham's Muybridge Monuments text, and it certainly precedes Hollis Frampton's text, Muybridge and the Tesseract, which is quite a bit later on. In the film,
I read and got jealous over,
Wow.
But it was.
I don't see why.
More eloquent than what I had written. But
I mean, you characterize the film as a documentation.
Yeah.
But I think we take animation in the strong sense as a reanimation, as a renewal and a reactivating. I think that takes it's the reason why this film is more than an art historical film. It's the compulsion and the fascination about it is more than a merely art historical interest. So there is something about this film that exceeds the interest that you've described at the time, Solowit and Andy Warhol. These are relevant, but there is something more going on in this film which accounts for its compulsion. And maybe even one way of signaling that is because you begin with a quote from Mao Zedong, which is something it's hard to imagine some of these other figures mentioning. So I actually have True. My copy of Mao Zedong's 4 Essays in Philosophy. I have it here. And I have the actual essay on contradiction that Tom quoted. I'm going to read just once more it's the second paragraph from chapter 3, The Particularity of Contradiction, which is, it's from 1937, in fact. It's when Mao wrote it. And so the text reads as follows. Man's knowledge of matter is knowledge of its forms of motion, because there is nothing in this world except matter in motion, and this motion must assume certain forms. And Mao goes on and on from there. And it's page 35. I wondered if you could talk a bit about that, just that as a kind of, as a preface, as a kind of jumping off point.
Yeah. Well, I think when I read that, it struck me as a kind of statement of his My Bridges project, and also I was struck by how there was kind of a similarity between that and some of My Bridges' own writings on his project, so. I guess it was also a way of claiming that Muybridge also took a materialist approach to his work and had a materialist understanding of the work, which, as I remember, at the time the film came out, was a controversial idea. I think many folks disagreed with that. I mean, it was kind of, I guess, speculation, you might say. I guess that's why I put it in. Also, I think I put it into, annoy some people, which is something I like to do in one way or another in each film.
Were you a Maoist at the time?
No, not at all. Let's see. It's a funny thing. I always knew a number of people who were Maoist, and when I was a student at Berkeley in I was at 61, 62. Most of the brightest people politically were Maoist, and but at that time I was sort of among left wingers at Berkeley, kind of more conservative, within the sort of left of the Democratic Party, I guess you'd say. We found ourselves allied with the communists against the Maoists then. And then later, yeah, when I was, I suppose around the time I was making this film, I also was friends with some people who were Maoists, but, and they were also quite intelligent, I thought, and I was, I don't know, intelligent, sexy, yeah, I kind of envied them also. So why wasn't I? Well, I don't know, it didn't seem to me relevant to American context, Maoism. Yeah, just, yeah, it didn't make sense to me. But I did like, of course, I liked those, his four essays on philosophy. I did like, yeah, I mean, you know, I liked his writing, and I got a kick out of it for sure.
If we have a think about that, the prospectus section, which is, it's kind of a summarization of a significant arc of the film. It kind of, the film effectively summarizes itself, then tracks back to Muybridge's, you know, Muybridge's landscape studies in San Francisco, then moves forward to his Central American expeditions, then his Yosemite expeditions, and then comes to the two sets of motion studies. So in that prospectus, there is a kind of, it's a kind of, it's not exactly an extended trailer, but it's a compressed mini film in itself. And that already tells you that there's something quite extraordinary going on in the film, because there's immediately Dean Stockwell's voiceover it narrates the scale and the epic, especially of the animal locomotion study. But you immediately realize that what we're seeing are moments. We're seeing moments from the study. The film will not give us the whole study. It will give us plates. And we begin to see the language that you employ, the language of the slow zoom into the detail of Muybridge's face, mm-hmm. or a slow zoom out, or
where... Well, it's not a zoom.
Well, please explain it then. Is it a rostrum camera?
Huh?
Is it rostrum work?
Oh, yeah, yeah. What you call... Yeah, we call it just animation camera. Yeah, it's probably those shots were shot on an Oxbury yeah, in those days you had to spend a lot of time filling out what were called exposure sheets that gave the exact coordinates of the camera for each frame of the camera movement. So I would call them tracking shots rather than zooms.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so we begin to see the kind of the vocabulary of the film, the building blocks of the film. They start to take place. We see the tracking shot in. We see the tracking shot out. We see still shots, and we realize that the film is about creating a way to creating a contemporary form to study a pre-cinematic form, creating a kind of what Nicole Brenner calls a figurative project, so that we, the spectator, can have an encounter with these images from a world before cinema. So cinema allows us to study a world before cinema, and it allows us to study images before the cinematic images that we need to study it. So there is a kind of, it becomes clear that there's a dialectic relation. The cinema which defeated Muybridge, mm-hmm. is what allows us to revisit Muybridge. And that the vocabulary of cinema has to operate on these dimensions of tracking and slowness and stillness in order for us to pay attention. because it's actually quite difficult for us to pay attention. And what I love about the film is the excitement by which you reconstruct My Bridges project. So that My Bridges project, which is a project which is somehow consigned to the prehistory of cinema, stops being a prehistoric, pre-cinematic project and starts becoming an adventure in its own right, like a project which at the time nobody knew how it would turn out. In other words, you restore contingency to his event, and it's as if we are seeing these images as if we're seeing them for the first time. And so there is an invitation to ask the spectator to occupy at this double optic. We are in the present, but we are invited to look at these images with the shock that they created at the time of their invention. And it's a remarkable time-traveling project, which is actually deeply exciting. And I think that's what separates the project from other ones. It's as if My Bridge is both our contemporary and he's far ahead of us, because he does something astonishing, and it's all there when the script links the project of motion study to the project of the optical unconscious.
Yeah.
The link to Benjamin starts to signal that.
Yeah, that's those are actually things that I was conscious of when I was making the movie, although I'm sure I couldn't have put it as eloquently as you just did, but I thought about that stuff. Yeah, I actually did. Yeah.
When you talk about the optical unconscious, yeah, and when you talk about the role, this phrase that we understand now,
yeah,
to connect it to the motion studies means for us to. It's as if we're becoming conscious of that which was unconscious for the people who watched it then. It's as if we gain an insight into what they couldn't gain an insight to. It's just a profound moment. I wonder if you could, and because the way that happens is through the different kinds of animation that you employ. So what I really want to get to is animation, which,
yeah,
I think animation is largely what our contemporary image world is based on. So animation is what structures a lot of our image horizon. So when we look at that the kind of cell animation that you were working at with this, it doesn't look dated or historical. On the contrary, it feels you were onto something quite profound about what it means to animate images from the past so that they confront us with their presence. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about different kinds of animations that are going on in the film. For example, the incredible sequence with the expression of hands, for example. Could you talk a bit about that moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true that when I, first of all, that I tried to think of as many possible different ways to put these photographs into motion. First of all, one way was just through dissolves, which is anticipated in the sequence of trees and clouds, where the images kind of merge into each other in a way I think is turned out quite beautifully. So there dissolves, and then sort of various different speeds of animation. And so that only at the end does it become some of the dissolves are quite beautiful. I thought maybe in retrospect that I shouldn't have animated the early photographs as much as I did, so that I could save the animation for later. But I guess the first time that I animated something kind of following his notes exactly, was in the sequence where it's kind of flashing the the sweeping and the guy in bed, where in those cases there's a 325 thousandths of a second, which is can be imitated in modern cinema by what did I say? I forget because I missed that part of the movie. So that was the first time there was something close to following him, and then finally in the sequence at the end, I tried also to not only to animate them, but also to respect the ways in which the cameras move, so that you know each image becomes displaced a little bit from the previous one. So trying to be as accurate as possible, and then so. Indeed, I didn't know how it was going to turn out until I shot it and looked at it. So I was quite happy with the way the elephant turned out, of course, and also the girl running and the sequences of Ben Bailey, and then the final sequence. Okay, so I had to I cut out. Cut out these little, cut out the Muybridge from the grid, and you just had him, his figure, which was also something different, and that was a very, actually a very complex shot to make, and it took me a long time to figure it out. So it was kind of. A surprise to me.
Yeah.
What happened?
At one point, the voiceover says that, you know, contemporary cameras can do what... Contemporary cameras and contemporary projectors can do what Muybridge couldn't do, and what he could do with his images, what he himself could not see.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So that it's as if your camera can realize a latent possibility that was dormant. It could renew the implied force of what Muybridge's motion studies implied.
Yeah.
And I think we can see that clearly in a couple of incredible scenes. One you've described already, the two scenes of strobing, which are extremely striking, extremely compelling. When you characterize the relation of darkness to light, that Muybridge's frames capture specific exposures, and all the rest is light. And then...
Lost,
All the rest is lost, and then we proceed to see this relation of darkness to light.
Yeah.
And then the other...
I hope I wasn't being sentimental there.
No, I think it's striking. And then the other scene, maybe even more shocking, is the scene where you reanimate the convulsing female model, and there the animation takes on this moment where you're talking about the kind of objectifying gaze, and it takes on a kind of clinical and anti-humanist perspective, which is totally compelling and somewhat alarming. It reminds me of J.G. Ballard's writing on Muybridge, where he talks about Muybridge as a kind of kit of time, a kit for disarticulating time. And these bits where you compulsively animate the way in which Muybridge compelled this woman to convulse. So it's as if the film convulses and re-inscribes her convulsion. Could you talk a bit about this sequence, which is a really strikingly... shocking sequence, literally shocking.
The artificially induced convulsion.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
I don't know. I think this was a kind of Francis Durkham, who wrote a paper about artificially induced convulsions. I don't know. I think he was kind of a really sort of a pseudoscientist, and studying his work, I think there was at the time a kind of notion of treating mental illnesses that was kind of there was a cruelty in it, and it was a kind of, I think, quackery. And in this case, I mean, obviously, the women who were involved in this, in those sequences were, I think kind of, victims, really. I mean, I've tried to, create a convulsion myself that way, but I guess I've never been able to, keep at it long enough, so I can't really say that it doesn't work, but I mean, maybe it does, that you can induce a convulsion by just trying to hold your hand just barely in contact with a table for a long period of time, although I have my doubts, but anyway, well, I guess. Yeah, I guess it happened. Huh? We saw it in the movie. Yes, and what did Muybridge say? The convulsion was of considerable violence. So it was a success. I suppose I should have said more about that, and I intended to at one point. It happened that... the final money that we got for finishing the film came from television. It was for television production. It came through the California Arts Commission to the local public television station and through them to me. So one of the conditions was that the film had to be standard PBS length, which was, at that time, for an hour slot, 58 and a half minutes, or for an hour and a half, it would be, I guess, 88 and a half minutes. And I think it happened that the best cut of this film was really the 73-minute version, which, well, we couldn't... it was impossible for us to make it longer than 73 minutes without just padding it, but so we had to cut out about 15 minutes, so there was a lot of more commentary that you might expect now that got cut out, particularly the sexual stereotyping that one sees in the sequences. You know, the roles that are assigned to men and the roles that are assigned to women, and how that, you know, represents a certain kind of, I could say, Victorian understanding of what's proper to men and what's proper to women, except that it hasn't changed all that much since 1885. So, yeah, we cut that out, and I thought, well, okay, that's a good thing to cut out, because that's the first thing that someone else is going to write about in relation to Muybridge. But I'm not sure that anyone really did, or that there hasn't been more written about that. So maybe we should have left that in. Now, have I gotten away from what we were talking about?
No, it's. I think it's come around to it. I mean, I just have another.
Oh yeah, we were talking about the artificially induced convulsions.
Yeah, but I think it relates to to the really striking scene, which I think everybody could not fail but be really quite stunned by, which is this, you know, throughout the whole film, in a certain sense, the grid is as compelling as the figures, because the grid is the kind of, it's discipline. The grid is the rule, it's the norm, it's power. It's like the whole thing is like a scale model of how power works, and the grid is our reality. We recognize it. We recognize the grid from computer games, from screens. We recognize the grid totally. So that the grid is continually there as a contemporary phenomenon. So we see that all the time. But because it's black and white, even though we know the grid is a contemporary form of power as apparatus, we can still consign it somehow to the past. And then, in that final scene, it stops being the past and becomes the 70s. And you have these two women walking towards each other, and they're like in glowing, vibrant colors. It's strobing, like in a kind of like a disco from the far future. They're walking towards each other, and they're these kind of models. They're like attractive young women, and they walk towards each other, and they slowly, very languidly, very elaborately bend towards each other and kiss each other. And it's as if they're women from a future. It's as if they're daughters of the grid. They're like synthetic. They're synthetic beings, you know, like tomorrow's Eves. And it's really, it's a kind of a stunning moment. And, you know, it's implied by the film, but it's nonetheless a surprise. And, you know, could you talk a bit about how that, you know, not so much what you meant by that scene, but how it came together? Because it has this elaboration to it, which puts it into something else.
Now you're mentioning things that I hadn't thought about, I must confess, in making the film or even thinking about it subsequently. How did I come about that? I'm sure it was one of the first ideas in the film, although it wasn't actually shot until the very end of the production process. All I can remember is I was thinking, well, I'm going to explain this thing by, you know, Leonardo da Vinci's his description of persistence of vision and his anticipation of the science of the 19th century. And I'm going to have this scene that will make it completely impossible for people to understand what is being said. That's the only motivation I can remember for that scene. And why I wanted to do that, I have no idea. But I guess it just kind of amused me, you know. Doing that. Yeah, it does seem kind of like a logical conclusion to the film, though, right? To do my Muybridge, an imitation of Muybridge, but in color. And yeah, I think that was a zoom. It was a. Oh, I know what the thing is. Yeah, when. I think in 1966, when I started the film, that wouldn't have been possible because the camera that was necessary to do that didn't exist. That is, we were it was a matter of shooting, I think, something like 256 frames per second. And it was only... Right before we made that that scene, that there was a camera that could shoot at such a high rate of speed, but also had a pin movement so that the image was steady. So before that, you would have been able to shoot that much, but the image would have been kind of all blurry because of the fact that there wasn't a pin movement in the camera. So, what does that mean? We have 10 more minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Timeout.
We need to get the next
reading up from
by 7.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. Yeah, so I don't know. That's
okay. Do we have time for one question from the audience? Okay. So I have lots of questions, but I've talked too much. So Michael says we have time. We can go for one question. I'm sure there are many questions. Yes, Tamar.
Yeah. Well, aren't there? I mean, in Muybridge's sequence, sometimes there are like little narratives going on, right? I mean, little anecdote stories, you know, like the refractory mule or the shock to the nervous system, you know, pouring cold water over someone, which I thought was a joke until it happened to me recently. And it really is a shock to the nervous system. Maybe to more than the nervous system. But, I did think that there were tiny little narratives quite often in Muybridge's scenes. But, you know, as to narrative in this film, I don't know. I thought there's some narrative, but, if not, that would make me just as happy, for sure. Not being all that good at narrative or really interested in it that much. At least I'm interested in it, you know, but I'm not interested really in making narrative films. Is that, I don't know. That's
the scale blowing up?
Well, I don't know. What do you think?
We can talk about it afterwards. I think there's a lot of time to talk about scale and magnification, which I think is critical. I had a whole question about Martha Rosler's vital statistics of a citizen.
Oh, yeah.
And this question of the invariant grid. There's so many things to talk about, but I know the Michaels are beckoning. I'm not going to bring it to a halt. I'm just going to bring it to a pause.
It's not a question I can answer in a few words, I think.
Yeah. We'll have to bring it to a temporary halt and continue afterwards. So if everybody would like to join me in thanking Tom Anderson for bringing his film to London. Thanks for coming along, and please stay for the next film. Thank you.